is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, this is Brendan Winters from Pro Skills Basketball, and you are listening to the Hoopheads Podcast.
Hey, Hoopheads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
To a young coach, some advice, you know, what do I want to do if I want to make it in this profession? It was be willing to work for free as long as possible and be willing to move at the drop of a hat.
Sean McDonald is the boys' head varsity basketball coach at University School in Hunting Valley, Ohio, taking over as both coach and athletic director in 2016. From 2003 to 2016, McDonald served as the men's basketball coach at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. While at Case, three of Coach McDonald's players were finalists for National Player of the Year honors, and three of his players received Academic All-America recognition. Prior to taking the reins at Case Western Reserve, McDonald served as the head basketball coach for three seasons at Hiram College in Hiram, Ohio. Hired at the age of 25, McDonald was the youngest NCAA men's basketball coach in America in 2001. From 1996 to 2000, McDonald served as the men's assistant basketball coach at Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts, and at Lemoyne College in Syracuse, New York. Between 1995 and 2005, McDonald directed a number of developmental summer basketball clinics in Greece, South Africa, the Republic of Macedonia, and the Czech Republic. These experiences abroad motivated McDonald to organize summer trips to Brazil in both 2007 and 2010, as well as Costa Rica in 2013, while he was at Case Western. As an undergraduate at Boston College, McDonald was a student assistant coach, where he contributed to the development of six future NBA players. We have Hoopheads Pod webinars coming up with NBA shooting coach Dave Love and Tyler Whitcomb from West Michigan Aviation Academy. And if you missed any of our previous webinars, you can buy the replay for just $4.99 on the Hoopheads Pod website. If you're focused on improving your coaching and your team, we've got you covered. Visit hoopheadspod.com/webinars to get registered. Make sure you check out our new Hoopheads Pod network of shows, including Thrive with Trevor Huffman, Beyond the Ball, the CoachMaze.com podcast, Players Court, and our first three team-focused NBA podcasts, Cavalier Central, Grizz and Grind, and Nuck If You Buck. We're looking for more NBA podcasters interested in hosting their own show centered on a particular team. Reach out to me at mike@hoopheadspod.com if you're interested in learning more and bringing your talent to our network. Have a pen and paper handy to take some notes as you listen to this episode with Sean McDonald from University School in Hunting Valley, Ohio. Hello, and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host, Jason Sunkel. And tonight, we are pleased to welcome to the podcast from University School here in Cleveland, Ohio, Sean McDonald. Sean, welcome.
Thanks very much, guys. I certainly appreciate you having me on today.
We're excited to have you on and dig into all the things that you've been able to do in the game of basketball at various levels. I want to start out by going back in time to when you were a kid. Talk to us a little bit about how you got into the game when you were younger.
For sure. I grew up in a small town in upstate New York, just sort of off the New York State Thruway between Syracuse and Albany. And there's a liberal arts college in the town where I grew up, Hamilton College. And my best friend's father was the basketball coach and the athletic director at Hamilton. And so it was a small town, and we played, you know, multiple sports, you know, from the time we were kids all the way through high school. So everybody in the town, if you could walk and chew gum, you needed to be a multi-sport athlete. And so I was like all of my friends. And yet I think because of my friend's father, Coach Murphy, Tom Murphy, who's an incredible coach, won over 600 games at Hamilton. I think it was growing up, you know, around his program where I maybe first had a little bit more of an appreciation for basketball, a love for basketball, than than all the other sports that I played as a kid, like every kid, you know, sort of flavor of the month and playing, you know, multiple sports throughout high school. And so it was probably that, you know, access and that, you know, I guess awareness to basketball beyond my little bubble of a small town that was kind of unique for me and was maybe, you know, a little bit of a, you know, initial springboard for what I've been able to be fortunate to do all these years. So
were you able to get into the gym with that connection?
Yeah, for sure. Sometimes I was welcome and sometimes I'd get kicked out. But yeah, absolutely. It was, you know, the campus was maybe a mile and a half from my house. And so I was with my best friend all the time. But when there were moments when I wasn't with him, I would certainly try to weasel my way in. And the guys that played for Hamilton, you know, many of them are still coaches to this day. Kyle Smith, who's the head coach at Washington State, was a, you know, really good point guard on a great team in Hamilton. And those guys were in many ways my heroes because I had access to them in ways that, you know, maybe other people that were season ticket holders would have access to a pro team. But when you grow up in a town of 1,000 people, that's your pro team. And so, you know, watching those guys play when I was young, getting a chance to play, you know, with them as I was older, whether it was, you know, during the summers, you know, or breaks, was something that was, you know, really cool and really memorable. But yeah, for a town that didn't have, you know, that much going on in it, we were always pretty lucky to be able to access a gym and access a place to play, which was pretty cool. So
did you get to go to a lot of games when you were growing up, not only just playing in the gym, but just going as a spectator?
Yeah, so for sure. So where I grew up was Syracuse Orangemen country. And so New York State doesn't have a flagship state university the way Ohio does or the way Michigan does. And really in central New York, there aren't that many natural sort of fits in terms of professional sports. So some people like the Yankees and some people like the Mets and some people like the Buffalo Bills and some people like the Jets. And everybody loves SU. So I grew up going to Hamilton College games all the time and playing with those guys. And so those guys were, you know, they were bigger, faster, stronger than me, but I could sort of view myself as, you know, maybe being like guys like that sometime. And then when you'd go watch SU play Georgetown in front of 35,000 people, you know, that was like watching, you know, the Bulls against the Knicks. I mean, that was like watching superheroes. So yeah, basketball was something that was, you know, a constant sort of part of, you know, my upbringing and my friend's upbringing. And whether it was playing, whether it was, you know, attending as a spectator, whether it was, you know, going, you know, to watch other high school games, it was just something that was a great, you know, sort of part of my childhood. And it was certainly a different time. It was, you know, probably a time of a lot, you know, more innocence, if you will. And so there wasn't as much to do. So you'd either be playing or you'd be watching other people play. So
yeah, no question about that. It was definitely a different era. We can get into that in a second. When you think back to that time and being a Syracuse fan, who was your guy or guys that you grew up a fan of?
What's funny, so I moved to upstate New York when I was in sixth grade. And it's funny, so I'd grown up in Grand Rapids, Michigan before then. And so the first day, like my parents took me to my new school and I'm standing there in the middle school office and the varsity basketball coach just happened to be in there. He was a PE teacher and somebody said, you know, this is Sean, the new student. And he was warm and engaging and started asking me, you know, what I liked. I started talking about basketball and he said that he, you know, works basketball camps at this place down in the southern tier of New York State. It was Golden Valley Basketball Camp. He's like, oh, you should come with us. And, you know, every year, you know, whether it's, you know, Akeem Olajuwon or, you know, Pearl Washington or Jim Boeheim. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. These guys come to camp. I mean, it was, you know, I was sick. You know, I think I was in sixth grade. And so I was just mesmerized by the names. But it's funny, after my, you know, sort of first winter living there, although I went to SU games and I, as an adult, I probably, you know, had an affinity for SU. I decided, I thought I'd maybe be the contrarian. So I rooted for Georgetown.
Wow.
I don't know why, probably something I'm not overly proud of. I later on went to Boston College and didn't root for either of them, you know, but,
Absolutely. So
I got to see great, great players at Syracuse. My goodness, back when, you know, Derek Coleman and Ronnie Cicely and Sherman Douglas and Pearl Washington. I mean, it was just unbelievable. And that was a time after Ewing, but, you know, when David Wingate and Reggie Williams and Alonzo Mourning were at Georgetown. And I mean, the Big East was just awesome. I mean, the Big East at the time, I think probably most people, unless you lived in a pro town, probably most people would have said that Big East basketball was the most entertaining basketball that there was. Now, maybe if you lived in Boston, you'd say the Celtics, or if you lived in, you know, Atlanta or something, you'd say the Hawks. But I mean, Big East hoops was awesome. So to be, you know, sort of right around the corner from it was something really cool, and something I'll certainly always cherish. So
yeah, people in the generation after us, I don't think necessarily remember how big that, you know, those big Monday games were, and just how much of a celebrity. You think about the coaches that were in the Big East at that time, and you think about the players that went through, and just, I can remember sitting again on my living room floor watching all those names that, you know, you just went through. And I, from a Syracuse standpoint, I always loved Pearl Washington. I just loved the way he could handle the ball and do things. And, you know, he never quite lived up to what he was in college as a professional player. But he was one of my favorite guys to watch as a college player, because he just, again, the way he handled the ball, kind of that quintessential.
An unbelievable showman, for sure. Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Kind of that quintessential, like, New York City point guard type of guy, just kind of epitomized when you think of New York point guards. You know, he'd be certainly in the top two or three that of names that you'd come up with when you think about New York City playground guys. And so I just always gravitated towards him. And unlike you, I was not a Georgetown fan. So I had an elementary school buddy who was a big fan of Georgetown, and I always liked North Carolina. So that 81 Jordan final shot game was kind of the culmination of our Georgetown North Carolina rivalry. So sure. I was always glad I came out on top on that one. Despite, you know, it's kind of amazing just you look back and think about the fact that, you know, the way basketball is played today, that Jordan spent 3 years at Carolina and Patrick Ewing spent 4 years at Georgetown. Whereas now those guys would be pushing, and clearly they'd be out one and done. And as the league ends up maybe changing that rule here coming forward, that those guys would, you know, at that time, you know, they'd be ready to come out. And those guys were both probably ready to play in the NBA right out of high school, and probably would have had the same amount of success that they had. But it's amazing that they spent as much time in college as they did.
Well, not only would they be one and done guys, they would have reclassified, and they would have been in college when they were like 16 or 17
right,
years old,
exactly.
To become pros as fast as possible, you know. And it's certainly a different, you know, a different era. And I think one of the things that was really neat about college basketball back then is the household names, because you lived with these teams and these players for 4 years. And so you could think back upon last season and you could project to next season. And I've certainly thought over the last, you know, 20 years, as you know, I was a college basketball coach and now I'm a high school basketball coach. And I'm like, goodness gracious. Like, I don't know if I could name, you know, the 10 best players in America. When I was 12 years old, I could name the 50 best players in
Absolutely.
America.
You Forget know? 10. I couldn't name five good players right now,
really,
to be honest
is,
with you.
It really
I think
is
last
different.
Last year was the first year that I think like we could all sit down and name Zion, Ja Morant, and I don't know if maybe, I don't know, who else could you name in that list? I don't know, but I'm just saying, like, you think about it now, I couldn't name him now. I think not having March Madness this year hurt a little bit, right? Would you agree with that?
Yeah, clearly.
For sure.
But what's interesting is I could, to your point, Sean, I could name, not only could I have named the college basketball players, but I could have probably named the first top 25 high school players. I always used to read my Blue Ribbon college basketball yearbook that would have the top 15 guys and then the next 35 kind of as honorable mention. I remember going through and looking at that every single year and knowing where these guys were from and what high school they played at and these different things that the scouts would say about them. And it was just completely a different world. I go back and I think about the Ralph Sampson versus Patrick Ewing, Virginia Georgetown game, which is maybe like 1984, maybe was when that game was played, and just how big of a game that was. I'm curious with your own players. So when you think about when you're at Case and then now at US, when you have conversations with your kids off the floor and you're just talking basketball, do they talk more? Are any of them talking college basketball at all? Or are they more talking NBA?
So it's interesting. I would say for starters, they're talking NBA. And if they were talking college basketball around me, I would change the conversation to NBA because that's, you know, that's what I certainly watch a lot more of
right
now. But I would say, you know, like all kids in this generation, the kids that I've been around are drawn more to the players than the teams, and they're drawn to the best players. And, you know, and there are kids that, you know, will be Duke fans, and I'll give them a, you know, a hard time about, you know, that or my own personal opinions or whatever. But I would say more than anything, I'd say, hey, if we're going to talk hoops, let's talk the pros, because it's the best players, it's the best coaches, it's the, you know, highest level of competition. And frankly, it's the level that I'm most familiar with in terms of being like a spectator.
You a know? Fan, so, right, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
I agree. It's difficult, I think, and we kind of danced around it, but I think the big thing is that with college basketball, when you go back to the era when you and I were growing up, those players, because they stuck around for 3 or 4 years, you got to know those players. You got to know those teams. Like, you can think of the Georgetown Patrick Ewing teams. You can think of the Ralph Sampson Virginia teams. And a lot of those players were the same every year. So you got to know those teams. You became fans of them, even if you weren't necessarily a fan of that particular university. Whereas now, I mean, just take Kentucky. Every year, Calipari has a completely different team. So unless you're a huge fan of Kentucky, because you live in Kentucky and you're just a fan of the Kentucky Wildcats, it's very difficult to build any kind of a connection with the team, because it's just, you know it's a one-year deal and then it's going to be a whole new team. So I think that makes it more difficult to follow college basketball. And then the other thing is, again, especially when you talk about the younger generation, is our TV viewing habits are so disjointed now. You can go on and watch things whenever you want, and there's so many more choices. And, you know, you think back to when we were growing up and you just laid on the floor. Heck, I can remember not having a remote control and having to go up and push the button on the cable box to have to change. And even before that, having to turn the dial to get to like an Ohio State game on UHF channels. And so it was a lot easier to watch college basketball back then, simply because there wasn't as many choices and there wasn't all that on-demand stuff. And you got to know the players. And so now the NBA clearly has more media coverage. And as you said, when you're watching the best players in the world, that's, again, where we all tend to gravitate. At least I know that's true for me. Like I said, I used to know everything about college basketball. And I'd say in the last probably 15 years, that completely shifted to where now I just, you know, I watch the tournament. I maybe will catch a Kent State game where I went to school, and I've always been a Carolina fan, so I might watch the Carolina Duke game. But other than that, I'm watching very, very little college basketball at this point.
For sure. And I don't really watch television per se, but I would imagine if you were someone that was drawn to, you know, sitcoms or TV cop dramas or whatever, and you didn't know any of the characters, why would you tune in?
Yeah.
Entertaining. Why would you tune in? Exactly. And I mean, all those years when I was coaching college hoops, and I was like, geez, oh, Pete, I know more about small college basketball than probably anybody in America. And I love the NBA, but who's playing in the, you know, ACC or the Big 12? I have no idea. I don't know who they are. And so it just sort of became a, you know, a new normal for me. So.
And as you get older and you get more responsibilities in your life, you have less time to be able to dedicate to seeking out information and carving out time to be able to watch games. So I find you just have to pick and choose.
Sure.
And find the things that you like the best and stick with those and just go with that. Because otherwise you can, it's really, really difficult to, we don't all have endless time the way we did when we were 17. So speaking
nice,
of, wasn't it? It's just, you look back on that, you're like, what did I do with all that time? I wish I would have taken more advantage of it in my life and realized how precious it was back then. I think that time, it's always, you know, they say age is wasted on the youth. Well, time is wasted on the youth. I think in a lot of ways that I wish you could go back and look at that time and say, boy, I should really try to accomplish some more things and get stuff done. But thinking of you back as a high school athlete, give me a memory or two, could be from any of the sports that you played. Just when you think of being a high school athlete, what are one or two memories that jump into your mind immediately about when you were a high school athlete?
Well, sure. I was sort of in season all the time, which I think is, you know, maybe still commonplace in, you know, small town, you know, small school America, but it's obviously less commonplace in bigger public and bigger parochial schools. So I really, you know, reflectively appreciate the fact that I got to, you know, compete, you know, sort of year round and was on, you know, really great teams, whether it was a soccer player, as a basketball player. The great Catholic school where I grew up in central New York is a sort of a mid-sized city, maybe like the size of Canton, Utica, New York. And so Notre Dame High School in Utica always had a great team, you know, guys that would go play Division One, and they had a team that won the state championship when I was a senior in high school, and we had a good team, but that was probably like the biggest moment of my senior year when we beat Utica Notre Dame, because it's a game that we shouldn't have won. You know, they had better players, and so memories like that are, you know, fun. And yet, you know, as a soccer player, I got to play for I don't know what it was, sectional championship or something, but in the Carrier Dome, you know, so we got to play, you know, on the turf in the Carrier Dome in our minds in front of 30,000 people. Of course, it was probably in front of, you know, 150 people, but
and they didn't have the video boards back then, so they couldn't pipe in any fans for you. You just had
no
to look
fan
at empty
noise
seats.
That's right. It was like our own bubble at the time, you
that's
know?
Right, so, exactly.
And so I just think that was, you know, it was special to be able to, you know, compete at a, you know, pretty high level in a bunch of sports and be able to, you know, have some success and, you know, all the while being able to do it with your, you know, with your buddies and doing it for your school. It was, you know, it was pretty cool. So I don't know if there's a specific, you know, game or a specific result, but those are, you know, a few kinds of things that stick out all these, you know, all these years. So
when you were growing up and get into high school as an athlete, were you at any point along the way thinking about coaching as being something that you knew you wanted to do, you thought you might want to do? Explain to us where coaching started to enter your mind, where you thought, hey, this might be something that I want to do for a career.
So definitely not when I was in high school. Like I said, my best friend's father, Tom Murphy, was a great small college coach. And so I, you know, grew up around the Hamilton College team. But for me, that was more just like, you know, access to college hoops and access to a gym and something to do for fun. It's nothing I ever thought of as, you know, a career path or vocational. And as I was thinking about, you know, college choices, and I was, you know, really lucky growing up, I was going to go to college, you know. And so as I was thinking about what I wanted to do, I just couldn't envision being in a, you know, a small town in the Northeast at a liberal arts college where I just, you know, spent, you know, all my years of, you know, middle school and high school. And were I to continue to play, it would have been at a, you know, small college. And so I had some family that went to Boston College, and it seemed like a, you know, sort of a natural fit. It was a good school. It was in a, you know, big pro town, which to me was cool and it was different. It was a Catholic school, and you know, my family's Roman Catholic. So it seemed like a great fit. And I got to BC, and, you know, within, I don't know, a couple weeks of being there, I thought, you know, geez, I might be a little bored. And not only am I missing competition, I know what I really miss. I really miss basketball. And it was like this aha moment, because like I said, I'd been, you know, whatever, fairly accomplished at, I guess, you know, a number of sports. And yet it wasn't that I just missed competing. I missed hoops. And so I called Coach Murphy and I said, you know, I'm not an idiot. I know I'm not a Big East player, but I might want to try out for this team. Like, what would I even do? Like, how would that even go?
What does that process look like?
Yeah, what does that look like? And so he was really good friends with two coaches on the staff, Tim Cohane, who ended up going to be the head coach at the University of Buffalo, and Rick Boyages, who, Jim O'Brien was the head coach at Boston College, and Coach Boyages had been the head coach at Bates College in Maine, and he competed against Coach Murphy's teams. So Coach Murphy said, well, I know a couple of these guys. I'll call them, you know, they'll call you. So a couple of days later, they said, come on down. And so they're like, listen, you know, I mean, if you want to, you know, try to make the team, that's great. You know, maybe it's 1 in 10, maybe it's a 1 in a million, but you're welcome to give it a try. And, you know, so I sort of weaseled my way into open gyms when the guys were playing. And right away, again, I'm, you know, I have self-awareness if I don't have anything else. So it was very clear to me, I can play with these guys, and yet I don't belong out here. But I tried out. I didn't make the team, but solely because of the, you know, relationship that these two coaches had with Coach Murphy. They pulled me aside and were like, listen, you know, you might really like this. I mean, you've been diligent, you've been resilient, you've been coming around here, and, you know, and maybe there's a path for you to find something that could work out for you. So my freshman year at BC, I did whatever was asked of me, and I, you know, went to every practice and every home game, and I would wear a number of hats, you know, sometimes a manager and sometimes a video guy and sometimes a gopher, and it never felt like work, never. And I remember at one point in time, my dad had come to pick me up, and we were driving from from Boston back to my home in upstate New York. And I thought, geez, I think I really want to be a coach. And he's like, well, what does that mean? How do you do that? I said, I don't know, but
yeah, what's your major?
I think I'm going to figure it out, you know? And so I started to talk to, you know, all of the coaches on the staff, but especially Rick Boyages, who's now the associate commissioner of the Big Ten for men's basketball, and a great coach. And he was such a tremendous mentor for me. And I said, I think I want to coach. And so here I am, I've got 3 years left of college and I don't even know what that means. And he was really encouraging. Hey, just keep coming around and, you know, we'll give you stuff to do. And you're clearly, you know, smart and you're reliable. And so before my sophomore year at BC, the NCAA got rid of the graduate assistant position. It was the time during restricted earnings coaches, and they were really trying to scale back and, you know, make a level playing field so that the North Carolinas of the world and the Cleveland States of the world were maybe playing on at least what perceived to be from a staffing perspective and even playing field. So our GA left. He went and got a full-time job somewhere else. And there was all this work that had to be done. And it could have gone on the, you know, backs and on the plates of the full-time assistant coaches. And Coach Boyages just advocated for me and said, you know, this kid, he can do a lot of this stuff. And he's, you know, again, he's smart enough. He's reliable enough. He keeps coming back. And so like my last 3 years while I was at BC, I more or less served in the role as the graduate assistant. And, you know, by then, I knew that this is what I wanted to do. I was spending all of my time doing this and skating by in terms of schoolwork.
Right.
And I mean, what a privilege and what a, you know, just a tremendous amount of good luck and good fortune. I got to work with six guys that played in the NBA. I got to work on a staff with four guys that went on to become, you know, Division I head coaches, and two other guys that went on to be small college coaches like myself. Coach O'Brien left BC and had a nice run here at Ohio State. And so as a young man growing up, no, I didn't even think about wanting to coach, even though I was around it all the time. And the moment that I was away from basketball, I missed it dearly. And then within a matter of weeks or maybe months, I realized that this is what I wanted to do. And it was all, like I said, good luck, good timing, who you know, and then getting a couple breaks and trying to not screw it up. So,
all right, I have two questions. One, I want to go back to your last experience as a player. What was the tryout process like at a school like Boston College? What did they have you guys do? How many kids tried out for the team at the walk-on tryout? Just what do you remember about that experience? And then I've got a question about kind of moving from the playing side to the coaching side of things after you answer that.
Sure. So, you know, BC is, although it's a, you know, a Power Five athletic program, it's not, you know, a flagship university with 50,000 students. I don't know, maybe there's maybe 8,000 undergrads at BC or something like that. And, you know, most of whom are worried about having a good time on Friday night, you know, in Boston, not playing, you know, college basketball. So it wasn't what I would envision, you know, at Ohio State or Michigan or North Carolina, but it also wasn't three guys. You know, there might have been, you know, thinking back, let's just say, you know, 20 to 30 guys who were there. And to the coach's credit, I mean, they were thorough. They were involved. Coach O'Brien was there. He certainly didn't need to be wasting his time with that. And when all said and done, nobody that tried out made the team, but a guy that was on the football team who played in the NFL down the road, he played after the football season ended, and he was way, way better than I could have ever dreamed of being. And so, but it was, you know, maybe a little bit of, you know, drill and skill based, mostly just watching guys play, whether it was, you know, small-sided half-court games or playing some, you know, full-court basketball. And I certainly, you know, knew in that instance, like, well, yeah, I'm fine in this setting. You know, like I'm pretty good
if
out
this,
here.
It's if just this was the Billy team set.
Yeah, when Billy Curley and Howard Eisley come out, that's when things get a little tougher for me, you know?
Yeah, so, absolutely. Yeah, well, there's something we said for genetic gifts, right?
Yes, yes. It goes a long way. It goes a long way. So that was sort of that, you know, that last moment. And then, and honesty, I certainly didn't play thereafter. And yet, you know, I spent most of my summers, you know, in Boston. So, you know, the last 3 years, I would, you know, find myself playing a lot with the guys in the summer, find myself, you know, playing, you know, sometimes in the preseason, just depending on bodies. And then it was more because it would be my responsibility to sort of help solve a problem as a member of this staff or something. You know, it's something that I'll look back on, you know, really fondly in terms of just an experience and one that never needed to be made available to me, you know, but because of, you know, some phone calls and some coaches that were welcoming to a kid that was just eager and wanted to be around, you know, I was really fortunate. So,
yeah, but I think there's something to be said there too. You know, obviously things worked out and your connections helped and people sort of lifted you up along the way. But I think a lesson here is that it also doesn't happen if you don't reach out and say, hey, I'd like to give this a try, and you don't pursue it. And then once you get into that job, if you don't just gladly take on all the menial tasks and things that other people don't want to do, maybe you're not as well received by the coaching staff and you don't then continue to get more responsibility and more opportunity. And so I think that's a great lesson for any young coach that's out there is, and we've talked about this a little bit before, I think Coach Showalter from USA Basketball was actually the first person who said it on the podcast, but basically you got to do a great job, whatever you're doing, because that's how you get noticed and that's how you get the next opportunity. If you're already looking out the door and saying, ah, this is kind of below me and I don't want to have to go get coach coffee or I don't want to go run copies, then you're probably not going to get that next opportunity. You got to be great wherever you are. And I think that's a great lesson for all the young coaches out there.
For sure. Kevin O'Neill, who is a longtime college coach, he was the coach at Northwestern and coach at Marquette, maybe assistant at Marquette. He coached the Toronto Raptors for a while, a five-star guy. And I remember hearing one time Coach O'Neill had said, you know, to a young coach, some advice, you know, what do I want to do if I want to make it in this profession? It was be willing to work for free as long as possible and be willing to move at the drop of a hat, you know, whenever the next opportunity presents itself. So if you're willing to work for nothing and move all over the country forever, chances are eventually. And then Chuck Daly, I remember one time also said on, you know, some kind of video or something when I was a kid, make the big time where you are. So I guess if you're willing to work for free anywhere in the country and you always treat it like the big time, then maybe you're going to have a shot, you know? So
then the opportunity may come your way.
Exactly. Yeah,
and then
sure.
you get to go to all kinds of glamorous spots and make lots of money and do all these great things, right? That happens for everybody.
That's right.
All right. Yeah. So my next question, when you transition from, all right, I was a player, now I'm getting this opportunity as a student assistant coach, you kind of got to go behind the curtain of big time college basketball. What was something that surprised you about what the coaches did on a day-to-day basis? Was there something that you're like, man, I had no idea they did this, or I had no idea they spent this much time doing that? What was surprising to you when you first got behind the curtain?
Well, the easy answer is everything, because I had no idea, period. And I literally went from knowing nothing to your point, behind the curtain, and there all of a sudden, everything was accessible to me. Coach O'Brien did a great job, I think, of empowering his assistant coaches to have, you know, sort of specific roles. Now, some people would maybe say the assistants could have or should have had more diverse experiences on the staff, but I think at the same time, it was very clear, you know, each assistant's strength, how he was going to contribute the most to the program. Let's empower those guys like that and let's run with it. So I got to work most closely with Rick Boyajis, and his primary responsibility was either player development or preparing the team, you know, in terms of film breakdown, next opponent, you know, self-scouting, opponent scouting, etc. And so that's where I ended up. You know, that's probably where a lot of the grunt labor was. I would help the other assistant coaches, Paul Biancardi, who now works for ESPN and at one time was the head coach at Wright State. You know, he and Dave Spiller were two tremendously connected assistant coaches in the world of recruiting. And my way of helping them, to your point, would be make copies, cut this out, help me with some mailer. And I would do it. I'd be thrilled to, you know, do whatever I was asked. I think I always had more fun when I was helping from the film perspective, because I was learning more. At least I was learning the things that I wanted to learn more. And I think right away, so we had some good teams. Well, we had a couple of great teams at BC. We beat your North Carolina team in the second round of the NCAAs years ago after North Carolina was defending national champions. And so I got to be around great players. But we also had one season that was really lean. It was right after a few guys had graduated and gone.
Was
to
that?
The
I got to interrupt you. Was that in D.C.?
It sure was. Oh yeah. Absolutely.
All right. So I was at that game.
Oh well, that was a heartbreaker for you then. So
it was because I. So I'm going to interrupt you and just tell a funny story. I don't think I ever told this story on the podcast. So I had a friend who he's like, hey, let's go to the NCAA tournament. Let's just go to D.C. I got a friend who lives there. We can just crash at his apartment and we'll go to the games. I know we'll be able to get tickets. It'll be no problem. We'll scout, you know, we'll be able to scout the tickets. We'll get in for next to nothing. You know, it'll be great. I'm like, all right, cool. So we drive to DC. We get to this guy's apartment and we start looking and we're calling like ticket brokers and the tickets are going for like, you know, it's like $500 for
can't
a ticket.
Get in. Yeah.
And I'm like a year or two out of school. You know, I'm like, there's no, like, I'm like, I'm just going to, basically I just drove to DC to watch these games on TV. So he's like, no, no, trust me. He goes, we'll be able to get in. I'm like, I don't know about that. So we go and we drive to, I think at the time it was the Capitol Center, and we're out in the parking lot and we got caught on traffic on the way there. We got caught on like the, you know, the, what do they call it there in DC, the inner belt, whatever it's called.
Sure.
And so we get there, we're like, it's like 10 minutes before the North Carolina game is going to tip off and they were playing against Liberty. And we go in there and we're walking around the parking lot trying to find tickets. No, we can't find anything. Finally, we get to a guy. He's like, I'll give you these tickets. The game's about to start. And he ended up selling to us like $10 for these tickets. And he had three. He's like, they're all in different places. So me and my two buddies, you know, you're looking at the tickets. You have no idea where the tickets are. You know, we don't know the Capitol Center.
Sure.
We know what section is, whatever. So we just, each one of us divvied up each one of us just grabbed a ticket. So then you go in the arena and their two tickets were like up in like the second to last row of the Cap Center. My ticket was in the third row.
Nice.
Behind, I was sitting directly behind the Reverend Jerry Falwell.
There you go.
For North Carolina's game against Liberty. And then I stuck around and watched that North Carolina BC game. So that's funny. The next, you know, whatever the next night or two nights,
sure.
You know, two nights later. So anyway, that's my story. So
no,
continue.
It's
I
all
apologize
right.
for interrupting.
No, it's no problem. And so the year after that, we had a team with some, you know, good players, Chris Heron, who's become, you know, famous for many reasons across the country and globally. He was a freshman that next year at BC and he got injured. Things didn't work out. And so it was a team that wasn't really prepared to win. There was no, you know, talent base in terms of upperclassmen. And that's when I really started to realize, oh, wow, if you don't have good players, then you're in big trouble.
And, no matter how good
that's when
coach
the Big
you
East
are,
was
right?
loaded. I mean, Allen Iverson, Ray Allen, Kerry Kittles, you know, John Wallace at Syracuse. I mean, it was loaded. And I'm like, geez, these guys are coaching their tails off. I learned so much and I was so observant and I realized, geez, at a certain point in time, none of this matters. Holy smokes, in terms of ultimately, you know, winning and losing, all that preparation. And the next year, Scoony Penn came to BC. He was a tremendous guard who ended up finishing at Ohio State. And, you know, we had a really good front court player. And the next thing you know, the team was really good again because we had, you know, some dynamic playmakers. But it was that one year I was a junior in college and we were not, from a talent perspective, just sort of, you know, equipped to, you know, win at that level. We could compete at that level. And I saw coaching and teaching and mentoring and preparing all over the place. And it didn't matter, you know, that was a really important, I think, eye-opening experience for me. So,
yeah, I'm sure moving forward that it helped you to kind of understand that perspective about you got to have talent in order to be able to win. And sure, coaching, you can improve, but you can only take your team to the level that their talent will allow. And that's, I think, a good lesson for coaches when you're out there is that you got, you know, we all think as coaches sometimes that, you know, we're doing great things. And then ultimately you realize that, yeah, the coach can provide the structure, but if you don't have the talent, the structure can be there. And if you don't have the players to compete at the level that you need to compete at, it doesn't matter how great your culture is and how great your offensive system is and how great your assistant coaches are. You're still not going to be able to get it done if you don't have talent, which speaks to the importance on the college level of being able to recruit.
For sure. And, you know, I certainly learned that then and then went on to appreciate it for the next 20 years of my, you know, of my professional life when I was in college basketball. And to your point, sort of the lifeblood of your program and, you know, you're hitching your wagon in terms of a wins-loss perspective is to the the talent of the young, you know, young men that you get to coach, and it can be humbling,
right?
If you don't have the horses, and then you better feel really lucky and privileged when you do, you know. So,
all right, one more question about BC, and then we'll move on to your first quote unquote real coaching job.
Sure.
So, at BC, what was your relationship like as a student assistant? What was your relationship like with the players? How much interaction did you get with the players? And then I'm assuming, because you had such a great staff, that those guys set it up where you were well respected by the players. But just talk a little bit about what that relationship was like between you as a student assistant coach and the players on the team at BC.
Yeah, for sure. The guys were great. I mean, they were my peers, right? I mean, they were my friends. So I think I was pretty mature to be able to sort of navigate what could be at times a fine line of the card game that I would be playing with, you know, the players on the back of the airplane. And yet when it was time to prepare for North Carolina or Washington State in the NCAA tournament, I had the opportunity to, sit and be quiet, but to sit in with the coaches, and the players were awesome. And I think, they saw me as a friend, but I think they also saw me as somebody who could be an advocate for them. I would be a sounding board. I would, probably get a lot of the grief or the complaining initially, and I could, be a helpful filter. And then I would, try to, navigate guys in a way that would seem to be what was right for the team while still being helpful for them. But I mean, just an awesome group of guys. BC is a special place that draws a really terrific, kind of person. And so those guys, were all like that. They just happened to be bigger and faster and stronger than most of the rest of the kids at BC.
Right, exactly.
So, it was a ton of fun. And like I said, it was not something that was planned, and it was, completely dumb luck. And yet what a wonderful springboard to what I've been able to do all these years. So.
All right. So talk about your first job. You get an opportunity to go to Lemoyne. Talk a little bit about how that happens and what that process looked like for you going from being a student assistant to getting your first real coaching job.
Yeah, for sure. So my intention after I graduated from BC was to go back to BC. Coach O'Brien had said, I would be welcome. And so what else did I know? So that's sort of what I was going to try to do. Again, it comes back to connections. So I was on the phone with Coach Murphy talking about something, and he said, you should call Scott Hicks at Lemoyne College. His assistant coach, Steve Evans, just left to go to Siena. You could be a good fit. And I'd remembered Coach Hicks as a player. He grew up a few towns over than me. He was older than me, but he's a great, great player. And he went on to be a great player at Lemoyne for John Beilein, who obviously was the Cavs coach and the Michigan coach. But he really cut his teeth in small college basketball in upstate New York. And so I called Coach Hicks and said, Coach Murphy said to, reach out. And this is what I've been doing. And if you have a position, I'd really like to talk to you. And I think it was the weekend. I can't even remember. But yeah, why don't you come on out? So I got in the car. My parents' house was 85% of the way to Syracuse. So I stayed with my folks. And then I went to Syracuse the next day or a few days later, where Lemoyne is. And I interviewed the job and I got it. And I spent 4 years at Lemoyne. Coach Hicks was my boss my first year. He went on to the University of Albany and then thereafter to Loyola College in Maryland. And after my first year of working with Coach Hicks, Dave Paulson, who's now the head coach at George Mason, had been the head coach at St. Lawrence and got the job at Lemoyne. And I got a chance to work with Dave for 3 years. And they're both great guys and terrific coaches. But my experience with Dave was really transformational for me. And my first year when I was at Lemoyne, I was younger than probably all of the seniors on the team. So there was still this sort of unique dynamic. Those guys were awesome. They were respectful. They never put me in a tough spot, being a young assistant coach. They treated me like an adult. They treated me like their coach. And we had some really good teams. And then my last 3 years, getting a chance to work with Dave, who is so smart, and he's a tremendous leader. I think I learned a lot about ultimately maybe how I wanted to be perceived, if that's the right way to put it, as a coach, and the connections with players and the relationships that you form with them can allow you to help them and build a level of trust that they need from you off the court. And then it allows you to have the platform to do your best as their you know, coach, as a leader of the program, you know, during practices, games, etc. And so I was at Lemoyne for 4 years. It was almost like a second college experience. I got my master's degree there and had a chance to coach some really good teams. Dave got the job at Williams College after his third year at Lemoyne. He was a Williams alum and went on to win the national championship at Williams a few years later. And I interviewed for the job at Lemoyne and I didn't get it. It was maybe the best thing that happened to me at the time. I probably wasn't ready for it, but I thought it was, you know, appropriate to put my hat in the ring, if you will. And it was that summer, or maybe the previous few summers, forgive me, just a little bit more about Lemoyne, but New York State has at least had, when I was a kid, the Empire State Games. So it was like a state Olympics, and there was two levels. There was a high school level and then an open division. And so in my summers, I was coaching the Empire State Games team with some really great small college coaches in upstate New York, Tom Spanbauer, who's the head coach at SUNY Cortland, and Kevin Broderick, who's the head coach at Nazareth. And so over 3 years, the three of us coached the open division team. And so I was an assistant coach for two of those summers. And then the third summer, I was the head coach. And again, I was coaching guys from Syracuse and from Siena and, you know, these high-level players. We'd have some small college guys that were really good. And then you get to play against the best of the best in New York State. There's a New York City team. There's a Long Island team.
And you used to have that in Ohio. Do you know that?
I did. So I, from listening to some of your podcasts, I can tell that there was something.
It was called the Ohio Sports Festival.
Yes,
and it was,
okay, for sure.
It lasted for, man, I don't know how many years. Not very many. I want to say 2, 3, 4 years. But I would always put together, we'd always put together a team. And we had, you know, again, other Division I college guys. And then 1 year we had Eric Riley, who played at Michigan.
Sure.
And we just, you know, we tried to put together a team. And my dad was kind of always my summer coach. We had Scott Roth, who played with us, he's probably 6, 7 years older than me, who went to Brecksville in Wisconsin and played a couple different spots in the NBA and had a long career overseas. And just, that was a blast. Again, it's sort of a, you know, it just doesn't exist. It probably doesn't exist anywhere anymore, because it was just a different era. But man, that was fun. And I'm sure from your perspective, doing it in the Empire State Games, I'm sure that was a blast getting a chance to work with all those guys.
It was an unbelievable experience, especially because of how young I was. And to have these two really successful small college coaches as we went into the third year of doing this together, like, okay, well, now you're going to be the head coach. And I was like, what?
Right.
Like, are you kidding me? And so all of the practices were convenient for me because I was the head coach. We had them all at Lemoyne, and we had a couple, you know, really good players from Syracuse, and that made sure that they always made it to practice because we were practicing, you know, right in town. And then, I mean, you know, we played against, you know, literally, I mean, just the best of the best in terms of college hoops, sort of out on the New York State, Eastern Seaboard. It was awesome. And so it was something I really look back upon as something that was, again, sort of transformational for me, because I had a chance to run my own practice. I had a chance to call my own timeouts. I had a chance to, you know, to win games and lose games. And it mattered. The players competed at a very high level. The venues always had great crowds. Yet to your point, I don't know if something like that could ever come back again. Number one, all those players are now on their own college campuses training and stuff.
Right, exactly. Yeah, they don't have the summer. They don't nearly have the summers that they did back when I was playing.
They do not. And so, you know, when I think back about my time at Lemoyne, it's a wonderful school. And like I said, I got my master's degree there, which was awesome. And I made great friends, the people I coached with and the guys I got to coach. Tobin Anderson, who's the head coach at St. Thomas Aquinas, who's been on your podcast, is a great friend of mine. He's an awesome coach. We worked together for a couple of years. Jonathan Sippis, who's the women's basketball coach at Wisconsin. We worked for Dave for our last year while the three of us were all at Lemoyne, and then the players themselves. So I got to work with great people. You know, I got to, you know, coach at a high level, but those 3 summers of being able to coach in the Empire State Games were awesome. And honestly, it's funny, during that summer is when Coach Paulson went to Williams, and it was Kevin Broderick and Tom Spanbauer who said, are you going to apply for this job? And I was like, I can't, meaning the Lemoyne job. I can't get this job. They're like, are you kidding me? Like, you're totally ready to do this. You could do this, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, holy cow. So I took their advice and I applied for the job. There was a job in New York State at SUNY Geneseo, which is a great small college in the New York State system that had opened up. And they said, you've got to apply for that job. And I was like, really? And Tom was in that league. You could coach, you'd be great, blah, blah, blah. List me as a reference. So I did. So that was sort of my first introduction to even applying for jobs. I'd been an assistant coach at Lemoyne for 4 years, and I'd never thought of applying for a job. And the third job I applied for that summer was the head coaching job at Hiram College here in Northeast Ohio. And at that point in time, I had confidence in applying for a job. I didn't need to ask those guys for their opinion anymore. And lo and behold, I didn't get the Lemoyne job. I actually went to Williams College with Dave that summer. I paid rent for probably like, you know, August and September or something. And then I ended up interviewing for the job at Hiram. And that was my first head coaching opportunity. But I owe a lot of it, again, to, you know, good luck and good fortune in terms of who my friends and my colleagues were, and then, you know, the advice they gave me. So
did you have a connection to Ohio or to Hiram in any way before you applied for it or got the job?
I didn't. And again, I mean, you just talk about dumb luck. So I'll tell you a few things. Any young coach who's wondering how to get a job when you're 25 years old, let me tell you the secret formula. So when I went to Williams College, Williams is, you know, regarded as like the top liberal arts college in the country. And they play, you know, at the highest level of small college basketball in the country. And so when I got to Williams, I just sent an email to the athletic director at Hiram, assuming, you know, they'd already hired a coach. I had no idea, but I just sent him an email and said, "Hey, I applied for your job. I'm not at Lemoyne College in Syracuse. I'm now at Williams College. I just wanted you to know that if you were looking for me, here I am." And he replied back and said, "Thanks. You know, that's great. Williams is a great school. We've actually decided to slow our search down a little bit. We want to have the players involved. And so we're actually going to wait." This might have been July. "We're going to wait until they get back to campus." And I was like, "Oh, wow." And I told Coach Paulson that. And Dave's like, "That could be great for you because that timing is going to screw up, you know, other guys who would say, 'Well, I can't leave them.
I can't do that.'" Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So I didn't know. I had recruited Ohio a lot. We had some really good players at Lemoyne from Ohio, a great forward from Boardman named Jesse Potter. We had a great, great center from Mansfield St. Peter's named John Tomczyk. So we had some really good Ohio players, but that didn't mean anything to the administration at Hiram College. But what did matter to them is that I was now at Williams College. So they flew me out. I'm out there interviewing. I'm 25 years old. I couldn't be any greener. And every person that the AD would introduce me to, he'd say, "This is Sean McDonald from Williams College." And everybody would say, "Oh, wow." And I was like, "Wow, this is really helping me out."
You know? This 2 months at Williams College is really making a difference,
right? I never
got
a paycheck from Williams. I paid rent in Williamstown, Massachusetts, but I never got paid up there. And so, yeah, I mean, the good fortune of the timing, they're the ones that wanted it to be later. And then I think that certainly helped me. And the fact that I was at this great, great school, if I hadn't gotten the job at Hiram, I would have gotten, you know, a small college job somewhere, because, you know, small colleges are drawn to, you know, people from Williams because it is sort of the best of the best. And I was working for a great boss in Dave, but as it turned out, it happened for me, you know, sooner rather than later. So
what was the biggest challenge going from an assistant taking over a program for the first time, maybe not specific to Hiram or maybe specific to Hiram, just when you think back to that time, clearly as I believe you were the youngest NCAA coach in the country at that point when you got hired. So what did the challenges look like in front of you when you walk in the office for the first day?
Well, again, to be self-effacing, there's a reason they gave the job to a 25-year-old, you know? So it was the team had had a good season the year before, and the head coach had gotten another job. It's actually the job in New York State, SUNY Geneseo, that I referenced earlier. And he's still there, Steve Minton. He's a really, really good coach, and he's had a good run up there. And Coach Minton had a good team at Hiram when he left, and a lot of the talented guys graduated. And so my first year at Hiram, after we had like an injury or a something, we literally had 9 guys on the team. And we had 4 very good seniors, tremendous guys, Clinton Bloxon, who played on Cleveland Heights' state championship team. So he's a Cleveland guy, and some other guys. Maybe we had 3 good players. So we had 3 good players, but we started a guy for whom college basketball wasn't the right place. And then everybody that came off the bench was fortunate that they wanted to play college basketball, that they were doing so at Hiram. And they were great, great kids and worked so dang hard. But I would say, you know, there was the the challenge of everything that I still didn't know. I was still so green. The team was in a place of just having experienced some success and yet maybe wasn't ready to sustain that success just because the roster was, you know, fairly thin. And then we're playing against heavyweights. We're playing against Steve Moore's College of Worcester team and great teams from Wittenberg. I mean, we were playing against great, great competition. And so my first year, we did have a couple of special players. We had some great games with some of those programs I just referenced. And it was my second year when those last couple of guys of the Mudville Nine graduated. And then it was literally starting all over. We had 17 freshmen on the team my second year, like come in, you know, and not all of them, you know, obviously played for 4 years. And that was really like as much of like rebuilding as I think anybody could ever imagine. Those guys that were freshmen my second year, a few of them went on to be very, very good players at Hiram. And I was privileged to coach them for a few years. And I left after a couple of years to go to Case Western Reserve. But I would say it was just sort of the fact that the program was in a place where there'd been a little bit of success. And so there were some expectations that were wonderful, and yet maybe they weren't, you know, as realistic as maybe they should have been. And so trying to navigate that while playing against these awesome teams and then really having to hit the reset button that second year. So there was a lot of learning, a lot of hard work, you know, being in a lot of high school gyms. And thank goodness I was 25 years old at the time. So, but it was awesome. I certainly forever have a, you know, soft spot in my heart for Hiram College, that's for sure.
So what did you learn there? Maybe pick out one or two things that you learned in that first stint at Hiram as a head coach that you took with you when you got the Case job that helped you to be better prepared to walk in there on day one and kind of know what you wanted to accomplish.
Sure. So because I'd worked for Dave Paulson for 3 years, I mean, he was just really spectacular at building really meaningful relationships with players and then holding them to a really high standard. And so I was coaching guys at Hiram. I was doing everything I could to help them achieve the things that they wanted to on the court, but probably more importantly, try to help them achieve all the things they wanted to off the court. And so, you know, at times serving as their career counselor and getting them an internship and introducing them to a Hiram alum or introducing them to a friend of mine in Cleveland and really building trust with those guys by being an advocate for them. And then all the while being able to be demanding of them as their coach, as we had, you know, aspirations that we, you know, we thought were attainable and that we wanted to achieve. There were things that I wanted to do at Hiram that when I saw the opportunity at Case, I thought maybe those things were more attainable at Case. And whether it's just because of the nature of the university, the resources that were there, the name recognition of the school, I thought that there were things that I'd be able to do for guys at Case that I really wanted to do at Hiram and maybe I couldn't. When I was an assistant at Lemoyne, we took a team, maybe after my first or second year abroad. We went to London for, you know, 7 days or 10 days. And I was, you know, part of raising the money and the kids had to chip in a little bit, but it was clearly like the best experience that these guys had had during their days as college players. And we played in the NCAA tournament, you know, I mean, we played great games, but I think to a player, to a man, everybody would look back on that experience. So I told myself, I want to do this. I want to provide this for my guys. And I wasn't at Hiram long enough to pull that off, but it was always something that was really still important to me. So when I got to Case, I just realized how impactful things like that would be for my guys. And so whether it's providing them a basketball experience or it's providing them access to something in the professional world, but ultimately having every one of them say, I got to do things, I got to meet people, you know, I got to have a better experience as an undergrad because I played in that program, whether it was at Hiram or if it was at Case Western Reserve. And I would hope in a small part, they would say, and because he was my coach, because he's the one that this is what he valued. So I think it was sort of just, you know, tightening that focus that it needs to be all about the players. It needs to be all about, you know, their betterment, their development, and their advancement. And then it was my job as their coach to serve them in those ways. So
talk to me a little bit about your recruiting philosophy. And obviously it has to do with the type of institution where you're working at in terms of the type of student that you can recruit. But just let's focus in on Case Western Reserve. Just talk a little bit about, as a Division III school, what your philosophy was in terms of recruiting and how you went about trying to attract players.
Sure. So Case is, you know, unique because it is an incredible, incredible school, highly, you know, selective. And almost all of the guys that I was privileged enough to coach over the years were very type A in terms of what they wanted to do as students, what they wanted to do professionally when they graduated. And college was going to sort of be a means to an end. And so I learned that right away. I learned that from the guys that I inherited who were, you know, good players and really great people. And if they said they wanted to be a dentist, that's what they did. And if they said they were going to go to law school, that's what they did. And so for me, it was having an appreciation for where I was working. So you're referencing Case. So while I was at Case, knowing that that's the kind of kid that would be drawn there, somebody who was, you know, incredibly smart, but also was very, very focused about what he wanted to do. Somebody who was really smart, but was thinking more broadly about their college experience, you know, and I'll figure it out eventually. I'm going to go to school undecided. I don't know. Maybe I'll do what my dad does, you know, that kind of thing. Those guys wouldn't necessarily have found what they were looking for at Case. They ultimately probably wouldn't have enrolled at Case. So I tried to just be very methodical about knowing who we were and then looking for guys that were looking for that and then checked all the measurables as players. But really, it was like the physical attributes of a player that were the last things that we considered. Because if somebody didn't want to be a doctor or didn't want to be a biomedical engineer and they didn't have a 33 ACT, then Case Western Reserve wasn't going to be the fit for them. So I think it was really important to know where I was working, who was going to find fulfillment there, and then look for the best players sort of within that box. And over time, and we were really lucky, I was privileged to coach some awesome, awesome small college players. And yet when you got done checking all of those boxes, you were looking at a unicorn. I mean, you were looking at somebody who was really, really unique. I could tell a quick story. I don't mean to tell too many stories. Tim Mattis, who's the coach at North Royalton over on the west side, he had a great player, a kid named Ned Tomich, maybe 10 years ago or something like that. And Ned ended up going to Cornell and was a great high school player. He was a 34 ACT. He wanted to be a doctor. And I think it was the morning after Thanksgiving. It was the Friday after Thanksgiving. And Tim called me and said, I want you to know that Ned's decided to go to Cornell and you did great. There's nothing you could have done. You know, you represented yourself and Case so well, you know, but it's Division I, it's the Ivy League. And I said, oh, Tim, you don't have to explain it. Like, that's a no-brainer. Like, what a great opportunity for the kid. He's a great young man. And Tim said, okay, well, trust me, the next time we have another guy, you know, I'm going to make sure that you're the first guy we call. I mean, getting to know you and respect you. And he was very flattering. And I said, oh, Tim, hold on now. You could coach for another 30 years. You're never going to have another guy
right. Like
Ned Tomich. You might have a Big Ten player. You might have 10 Big Ten players, but you're never going to have another guy like Ned. He's like, what do you mean? And I said, 6'7", number one in his class, 34 ACT, really good, but not too good, you know, not like Stanford good, you know, like it's just so unique, the niche that we're looking for. And he's like, oh gosh, I never really thought of that. And lo and behold, you know, a handful of years later, when Villanova's winning the national championship, I can't remember the name of the kid now.
Maurice Spellman.
Yeah, but they had a great, great player who in high school, you know, was from North Royalton before he ended up, you know, going to prep school out east. And I saw Tim at a Baldwin Wallace team camp or shootout when I was at US. And I went over and, you know, reintroduced myself. And he's like, oh, yeah, this guy recruited Ned. I said, I don't know if you remember, but I told you you'd have, you know, an NBA player before you had another kid like that. And you sure did.
That's awesome.
It was pretty funny. So, I mean, that's, you know, in a nutshell, I think it's really just important to know where you are and who's going to find fulfillment at your place and then work like heck to try to find guys like that, you know. And when you're at a place that's as unique and as special as Case and you're sort of pigeonholed into these metrics. A lot of coaches would see it as a negative. Like, you know, my team's average ACT would be a 31 or 32, and guys would say, "How on earth?" And I'm like, "Well, they're out there. You know, there's not a thousand of them, but they're out there. And when you find the ones that are also looking for a place like yours, and you play in this great league, you don't apologize for anything. You get your fair share, and you have a great experience." So,
yeah, talk a little bit about the league for people that maybe aren't as familiar with it. I know we've had, you know, we had Coach McGinnis on who succeeded you, and we had Coach Zimmerman on from Emory, and they both talked just a little bit about the big city feel of the universities in the league. So just talk a little bit about that, what that experience meant to you as a coach, but also meant to your players.
Sure. So it's really unique, and you're right. I appreciate you reference it. So the University Athletic Association is 8 like-minded research universities that are in these, you know, great urban cities across the country: Emory University in Atlanta, and the University of Chicago, and NYU down in Greenwich Village, and Washington University in St. Louis, just to name a few of them. And so there are places that when college athletics sort of made the decision to go from sort of major college and small college to, you know, maybe different divisions, you know, the University of Chicago is every bit the place that Georgetown or Notre Dame or Vanderbilt or Duke is. It's just that those Division I schools just made the choice to take athletics in one way as a part of their university. And then these Division III schools that I referenced, you know, have the same endowments, you know, the same selectivity, the same, you know, sort of, you know, panache in the world of academia. And they just decided to go another route, you know, with athletics. And so, but it was a chance to compete against, I mean, Hall of Fame coaches. Mark Edwards at Washington University in St. Louis won back-to-back national championships. And you referenced Jason Zimmerman, who's such a great friend of mine, and he's done an unbelievable job down at Emory. And so you're playing against, you know, incredibly talented players, playing for these awesome programs led by these tremendous coaches at these world-renowned universities. I mean, it's like fantasy land. And anytime I would get a call from a coach, and I'm doing it now as a high school coach, and somebody would say, "Oh, yeah, you know, coach, you know, Johnny here, he's the best kid I've ever had." And I'm like, "Of course he's the best kid you've ever had. That's why we're talking, because my right. whole team is everybody's best kid they've ever had." I mean, it was like fantasy land. And so being able to work with the guys like I was privileged to work with at Case, and being able to compete against guys that became really good friends of mine at these great universities, and flying all over the country, and, you know, having this Division I experience while they still got to have the balance that small college athletics provides was really unique. You know, Elon Musk's SpaceX company, you know, just put human beings into space and just had that, you know, splash landing. And one of my former players at Case, who was a great, great player, Mason Conrad, is a launch engineer for SpaceX, you know.
That's
so
awesome.
Mason Conrad is a part of what is now like sort of the next step in space exploration. And when he was 18 to 22 years old, he just wanted to compete, play basketball, and, you know, get a great degree in mechanical engineering. So stories like that time and time again are the real privilege of being able to work at places like those. So,
absolutely. So I know you mentioned when you were talking about the transition from Hiram to Case, you had referenced the ability to maybe take a trip abroad. And I know when you were at Case, you got a chance to go to both Brazil and Costa Rica. Can you talk a little bit about those experiences for you, both from a basketball standpoint and a culture standpoint, and the impact you felt like it had on your kids?
For sure. So I appreciate you asking. We did. When I got hired, it was my goal to take my first recruiting class on a trip abroad. And we were able to do that. In 2007, we went to Brazil. And I was fortunate to be given some flexibility and some autonomy from a fundraising perspective by our development office, and they basically said I could cultivate relationships with former basketball players who didn't have an established history of giving to the university. So I saw that, you know, half full instead of half empty, and, you know, began building relationships and first asking guys my first few years for their time, you know, for help. Could you help a kid get an internship? Could you help a kid, you know, who wants to work on Wall Street? You know, could you help a kid who's going to interview for medical school or whatever, those kinds of things. And then eventually hey, well, here's this idea I've got, and you know, could you help me in a different way? So my first phone call to all these incredibly generous guys was not asking them for money, but by the time I was asking for money, they were ready to help. And so I fundraised 4 trips. We went to Brazil twice, we went to Costa Rica twice, and then I fundraised for the team to travel to Belize, and that was the summer after I had left. And so my goal was, if somebody was going to play for 4 years at Case Western Reserve, they were going to have the opportunity to travel abroad and have this basketball experience. And I was motivated for many reasons, but one of them is, I think studying abroad is something that's a really cool part of, you know, a small college experience. And yet basketball players play 2 semesters, so they really can't do that. Football players can do it in the spring, and baseball players can do it in the fall, but basketball players, you know, really sort of miss out on that. So I thought it was a natural thing to try to provide for our guys, who are these worldly guys and have, you know, certainly had the opportunity to travel before they came to Case, or when they were successful in their professional lives, would have a chance to travel later on. But to be able to do it as a member of a team, I thought would be unique. And frankly, we went to Brazil for many reasons, but one of them was, I assumed that none of my guys had been to Brazil. I knew none of my guys spoke Portuguese. And I thought, well, then, you know, this might be something that's different. Everybody's going to Italy. And frankly, the kids from Case have been to Italy, or they're going someday. Let's do something different. So we went to Brazil in both 2007 and 2010. The reason we went back in 2010 is I learned so much from 2007 about what I would do differently, how I would change or shape the experience. And I don't want to say the second trip was perfect, but it was pretty close. and then the one thing that I learned from that is, it was a little less magical for me because it was my second experience there. And that's why I decided we're not going to go back to Brazil a third time, because I don't want any part of my familiarity to be contagious and rub off on the guys. I want to be as mesmerized and inspired, whether it's service that we're doing and providing, or it's, you know, sort of experiences in nature that we're being able to have, or it's competing in this, you know, sort of, you know, awesome basketball environment. I want it to be every bit as special for me, so that the players can see that and feel it for me. And so that's why we didn't go to Brazil a third time. But Mason, who I just referenced, we had a game against a team in 2007, and he got hit in the eye or hit in the mouth, I don't remember, but he had a deep, deep cut, and we had to take him to the hospital. And so our guide was going to take him. He spoke Portuguese, and he's a guy that I could trust. And he said, well, we're going to take Mason to the private hospital, not the public hospital. And he gave me this sort of look of, you can trust me with this. And I was like, okay. So Mason came back later, and the guide said, it was really good. I didn't know Mason's parents are doctors. I said, oh, yeah, they're doctors. He said, well, when Mason said that, hey, should I give my dad a call? My dad's a doctor. Everybody's antenna went up even further in the room. And so he sort of got the A+ treatment. I was like, oh, that's great. So later on, I said to Mason, how'd it go? You know? And he's like, well, coach, it was fine. It was great. And they took care of me. He's like, but if that's the private hospital, it really concerns me. What is it that the public hospital looks like? And what are those people subjected to? So we did lots of, you know, service, you know, experiences on these trips and lots of clinics. And yet sometimes there was that unscripted real life moment, because even when we would drive through the favelas in São Paulo or Rio de Janeiro, which are sort of the slums, for the lack of a better term, I mean, they're just these impoverished villages on hills where just like tens and tens of thousands of people live. And it's like where COVID, you know, was running rampant in Brazil, because people live in such close quarters. Well, even as we would go by the favelas, that would be scripted. We're on a bus, you know, the guide is sort of saying, you know, this is why these areas, you know, exist, and this is how they're unique. But Mason's trip to the quote unquote private hospital was one that I think was eye opening for him. And as a result, was something that was impactful for all of us. So we got to have lots of, you know, experiences like that. And again, I think every kid that I coached, I would hope, you know, would look back on the trip that we provided for them and say, that was the best, you know, experience of my college basketball days, or it was certainly among the best. And I was, you know, really pleased and proud to help, you know, be a part of that. So,
yeah, that's fantastic. I think when you can give kids a unique experience that they may or may not ever get a chance to duplicate later on in their life, either by design or by choice, that they may not get back to Brazil. They may not get back to Costa Rica. And the fact that you could put them in a different environment, especially at such a young age, I think that that just widens kids' perspective. And we all know that when you widen your perspective, especially when you're talking about the kids that you were fortunate enough to coach, who are bright, intelligent kids with a future that, you know, they're probably going to be the future leaders of, whether it's companies or, you know, in the whatever their chosen profession is, those are the people that you want to have that wider perspective and that understanding of how the rest of the world lives. And the fact that you were able to provide that as part of your basketball program at Case, I think speaks to what you were trying to accomplish. And it's kind of been a theme that's run through the podcast, Sean, about just using the game of basketball to teach more than basketball and making sure that you're trying to have an impact on young people. And I think that those trips that you just described are things that I'm sure they helped your team from a basketball perspective, whether it's through bonding or the basketball that you played. But as you said, what's more important is the impact that it had on those kids as human beings and people that are eventually going to go out into the world and have to try to make a positive impact. And there's a lot of positives, I'm sure, that came out of that for everybody who was involved, as you mentioned.
Yeah, for sure. I appreciate you saying that. I feel exactly what you just stated, and it was a really special thing to be a part of. That's for sure.
All right, let's talk a little bit about where you are now with university school. You move back from the college ranks and you are at the high school level. So talk a little bit about the transition, and then we'll talk in a little bit about your program and what you're trying to accomplish at US.
That's great. Thanks. So I always had an appreciation for US. I'd recruited guys at all of my stops along the way as a college coach from US, but it was always from afar. And in my last, second to last year at Case, our athletic director job opened, and I had this humbling groundswell of support within our department. Everybody saying, you should do this, you should do this, you would be great. And I thought I had a sense to what coaches were looking for in terms of an athletic director. I thought I knew how I could help and really what would be most impactful for coaches and for students. And it didn't necessarily always align with the people that I had worked for. So I tried to get the job and I didn't, but it was a really good experience for me. So maybe fast forward a year, 2 years later, one of my former players at Case, who's also a US grad, Tim Kane, you should have him on your podcast. He's outstanding. Tim's the head coach at Fairmont State, but he'd been the head coach at Notre Dame College. And Tim called me and said, hey, US has created this position, and it's a lot like a lot of the things that you said you wanted to do at Case. And I said, well, geez, I know what a high school athletic director does, and nobody has more of an appreciation for what they do. But I was interested in raising money, and I was interested in sort of, career planning, sort of next step in life for the students and the players. And he's like, no, I'm telling you. So he sends me this job description. It jumps off the page. So I thought, holy smokes, this maybe could be great. And so the head of school at the time is a guy that had played at Amherst College out in New England. And I was friendly. I'd served on a few committees with the head coach at Amherst. So I called him and said, hey, I think I could be interested in this job. Your former player is the head of school there. Could you put me in touch with them? Because I don't want to apply for something if I'm not interested. I like what I'm doing. I work at this great place. And so he said, sure. And so I went out to US, and every time I would go out to US informally and then eventually formally, people would hear what I was doing and they'd say, oh, well, we're looking for a coach too. And it's because the coach at US, Terry Lipford, who's a great guy, a great coach, had resigned from being the varsity coach while he was still staying at US to teach. And I said, well, I've got the coaching job I want, but, who knows? Maybe it could work out. And so I was fortunate enough to get this administrative position that I accepted and have to this day. And as soon as I was offered that job, the next question is, well, we now have to solve the basketball job, because the search has been, it's been going on and it's been open. And so we have sort of option A, option B, or you could be option C. And I was like, well, geez, I certainly hadn't thought about coaching. I'd thought about this other role and this other responsibility. But I did think there's no better way for me to have an appreciation for what it's like to be a student or what it's like to be a coach at US than doing it myself. And so I said, listen, it's going to be a ton of work. It's going to be a ton of time. And if it's going to pull me from other things, I just want to say right now, like, I can't do this half-ass. You know what I mean? Like, I only have one way I'm going to be able to do this. And he said, no, you've got support. There's great people here. And he was right. We have unbelievable people at US. And so I said, okay, well, then I'll coach as well. And as a small college coach, I always had an appreciation for the high school experience because of the big crowds, you know, the Eds Ignatius game or the Shaker Cleveland Heights game. I mean, when you're a small college coach and you're in an atmosphere like that, it's like, oh my God, this is intoxicating, because that's not
right. That's not what you're typically playing in front of.
That is not what small college basketball is. I mean, I played many games or coached many games when I was at Case against literally the number one team in America. And it might have been with 100 people in the gym, you know? And so I thought, well, this could be fun, you know, coaching high school basketball could be fun. It could be different. And I thought about some of those things. And we have a son who's now in third grade at US, which was a real draw to allow him to be a part of this, you know, community and this experience, you know, with me. And so there was all these things that seemed really cool about it. My first year at US, we had a lot of really good athletes, guys that were, you know, really good football players, lacrosse players, but guys for whom basketball wasn't their primary sport. And as a result, you know, we had some wins and some losses. And a few years later, we're in a really fortunate spot where our guys, almost to a young man, identify themselves as basketball players first. And I have more college basketball players on my team right now than I certainly did my first year at Hiram College, I can tell you that. So it's been fun, you know, playing and coaching in atmospheres that have passion. I heard Dan DeCrane when he was on your podcast recently, and Gilmore and University School have a really neat rivalry. And I tell our guys almost every time before that game, I'm like, listen, guys, like, don't take this for granted. You guys want, you know, to go to college and play in college. And I'm telling you, like, this is really unique. You know, this is really special. We had a district game 2 years ago against Shaker Heights where the gym was completely packed. We played Mentor in the Euclid District last year. The gym was packed. And I'm like, this is awesome. So there've been so many things about being a high school coach that I thought would be different, that I would enjoy. There are also some things that I didn't anticipate that I've now learned to sort of navigate on the fly, but I feel so fortunate and so blessed that things worked out. And again, it's dumb luck. The guy who was looking to fill this position had played college basketball for a friend of mine, and right, and I made a phone call, you know, so.
Well, what were some of those things that you learned that you didn't expect as a high school coach, some things that were surprising to you?
Yeah, for sure. So I'd say three things that I've sort of learned to navigate on the fly. Number one is the autonomy and the independence that college students and college basketball players have that 15 to 18 year olds do not, you know, and I never thought about that. And then if you think about, you know, your experience as you know, high school player, you probably lived close to your school, and as a result, you're sort of in that community. And yet, US, we draw from everywhere. So not only is there not the autonomy that a kid has, where if I just change practice on the fly, or I say, you know, come to the gym at a moment's notice, they live 40 minutes away from the school. You know? So and
they're not just walking across campus
from the
dorm.
They're not walking across the parking lot, that's for sure. And we're going to have a really special team next year, which really excites me. And two seasons ago, when these guys were all 10th graders, I mean, my whole varsity team was in 10th grade and almost none of them drove. You know, so I was like, oh my goodness. So that was certainly one thing. The second thing was working with multi-sport athletes is something that I didn't have to do as a college coach. And I was open to it. And I've, you know, really been, you know, energized by it and the cool opportunities it presents, the challenges it presents. But it was really new to me. And then the third thing I would say is being able to teach guys something for the first time. And that's really cool. When you coach somebody as a college player, you might teach them a different way to do it, but they've probably been told how to do whatever it is. And as a high school coach, and we're a K-12 school, so I'm, you know, teaching kindergarten through third graders on Saturday morning how to dribble a ball, and I'm teaching, you know, 10th grade varsity players, you know, how to do something that nobody's taught them before. And so those things, some of them I expected, some of them I didn't, but I've all really grown to certainly appreciate in terms of differences. So
all right, I want to ask you about your role as the AD when it comes to multi-sport athletes, because this is something that I think is an issue in high school athletics when it comes to players. We referenced it that you grew up playing multiple sports, and I only played one sport in high school, but I grew up playing multiple playground sports, I guess, for lack of a better way of saying it. So when you think about yourself, obviously as a basketball coach, you have a desire to have your kids playing more basketball. And yet as the AD, your role is to be able to facilitate all of the programs in the school. So how do you work with your coaches as the head of the athletic department to help them to A, understand your desire or the players and their parents' desire to be able to play multiple sports if that's what they want to do versus the needs of that individual coach in their program? Is that something that you set a policy as the athletic department that this is how we handle it? Is it on a individual basis? Just talk a little bit about how you handle that particular situation.
Well, it's a great question, and we're in a unique position at US. We not only support multi-sport athletes, we rely on multi-sport athletes. Now, we're a school of about 400 boys at the high school, but we compete at the Division I level. So we're obviously competing against schools with 2,000 boys, 1,500 boys. And so we really need our best athletes to play, as many seasons, as they can during their, 4 years at US. We also are really accomplished in terms of our outcomes. We've won 25 state championships. Kids go on to play, at the college level in varying sports every single year. And so we're this unique hybrid where if you were going to stereotype schools that still really have multi-sport athletes, you'd probably say, well, they're smaller, maybe community schools. And, that's just kind of how it has to be, like where I grew up. And if you were going to stereotype the schools that win state championships, you'd probably say, well, those are probably big public or big parochial schools. And if you don't have your mind up in terms of which sport you're going to play on day one, somebody's going to make your mind up for you on day two.
Right, very quickly, exactly.
And so we really, really encourage, young men to play as many sports as possible. We're really lucky to have a tremendous strength and conditioning coach at US, Carlo Alvarez. He'd been the director of strength and conditioning for both the Pittsburgh Pirates and the Cincinnati Reds before he came to US. So when we have him talk to athletes and we have him talk to parents about, listen, you can have a favorite sport and you can certainly emphasize that, but specializing, it's not healthy for you. It's not good for you. And frankly, in terms of the outcomes that you're looking for, a lot of that is going to be determined, like we said earlier, by genetics, not by just overtraining. And so have a great experience while you're in high school and let the chips fall where they may thereafter. And so we have coaches that really do believe in that and embody it. And more than anything, I think what we say is when an athlete is in season, he should be focused on that sport and only that sport. But frankly, when it's the summertime, let's let the kid choose what is most important to him and let him apply, those, talents and that passion, where he wants to. But let's try to have kids play as many sports for their 4 years at US as we can. And so we've had, some really good stories and some great success because of that. And we really, believe in it. But there is a time, as I said earlier, when you're talking about highly skilled sports like basketball, like soccer, where at some point in time, maybe guys do have to choose to go from three sports down to two if they really want to sort of hit their peak in that, highly skilled sport, just because they do need that refinement. And yet when you hear, well, this and the many of NFL guys were multi-sport guys, there's the cynic in me that says, sure, they were NFL athletes, of course.
Right, exactly.
Of course they play multiple sports.
For
guys
sure.
Like that can do anything they want, So I have great empathy for families when they struggle about how to advise their son. When I was coaching at Case and I was coaching these incredibly talented guys who by the time they were seniors, a lot of times were so worried about getting into medical school or so worried about going to work for Goldman Sachs on Wall Street. And I was like, guys, you only have one last chance at college basketball. Like the rest of the world will wait, enjoy this. And so I find myself sort of echoing that to families and to our students now. Like, listen, high school is so much fun. Like, yes, there is an aspect of college that's awesome. And if you're lucky, college sports, that's awesome. But don't take this for granted, because before you know it, it's going to be gone and you could have some really severe regrets. And so that's kind of how we try to navigate it, Mike. So
I think that's 100% right. And I've said that quite a few times here on the podcast, that I think one of the issues that we have as a country in terms of youth sports and youth basketball in particular is that so many people, no matter what level they're on, they could be a fourth grade travel basketball player. They could be a seventh grade AAU player. They could be a 11th grade varsity player. They could be a college player. Everybody, it seems, and in a lot of cases, their families are so often focused on what's next instead of just being in the moment and enjoying the season that they're playing. It's always, well, where am I going to go to high school, or where am I going to get a college scholarship?
100%.
You know, this year I'm on JV, but you know, I want to be on the varsity next year. Instead of just saying, hey, let me have a great JV season and enjoy it. And as a parent, just sit in the stands and watch your kid and have fun. And so many people that I see and that I talk to are so focused on what's next that they forget to live in the moment. And I wonder that if you got to talk to those people 5 years after their basketball career is over and after their youth basketball parenting career is over, do those people look back on it and say, man, I really wish I would have just taken the time to enjoy my high school experience and or enjoy my time as the parent of a high school player and just sit in the stands and enjoy and watch them play. And I know I've told people that when I think about my playing career, like I love playing college basketball, but playing college basketball was hard. I mean, there were many more moments probably I would say that were difficult and challenging and maybe not as much fun as compared to when I think about my high school career. I can't think of one moment where I was like, ooh, this drill I don't like, or man, this practice is really hard, or I'm not having fun, or this or that. Whereas I can think of those moments in college. I can't think of any from when I was a high school player. And I think so many kids today are just focused on that end game of I got to get a scholarship or I got to get to my college experience, and they forget how great the high school basketball experience can be.
Well, like I said, almost every time before we have a big game or a rivalry game, I never talk to my players about, you know, the fact that I was a college coach. They don't care, nor should they. You know, but,
right.
But
yep.
The two times that I will are, we're in the position now where we have a number of seniors that want to play in college and have the ability to play in college. And so I'm calling my friends, you know, and I'm going to help advocate for them and open doors for them at schools that, frankly, maybe many of them have never heard of, and yet it could be another transformational experience in their life's trajectory. So at those points, I will talk about my time as a college coach. And then the other times I'll talk about my time as a college coach is when I say, don't take this for granted, because this, you know, this atmosphere against Gilmore, this atmosphere against Menor, you know, last year we went down and played at Massillon Jackson, like this atmosphere tonight, like this is not, you know, what most of you will experience college basketball if you're fortunate enough to do it, because this is really unique. This is really special. You have fun with your buddies and just love it. So I feel really lucky to be able to share that. And I pretty much draw the line at that and only that. I don't talk about my previous days really other than that, because they don't care and nor should they. So.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. We've blown by an hour and a half here, Sean.
Sure. I'm really sorry, man. I could be long-winded,
no,
man. So.
No, man. It's all good. It's good. Every time, I say this all the time, you look up at the time and all of a sudden what seems like was 15 minutes all of a sudden is, you know, an hour and 15 minutes. So I want to ask you one more question before we wrap up. And that is, just as you look forward there at US, number one, what do you see as the biggest challenge for continuing to sustain the success that you've built? And then number two, what's the biggest joy that you get when you get out of the bed in the morning and you think about having the opportunity to be the AD and basketball coach there at US? What gets you out of bed in the morning with a smile on your face? So what's your biggest challenge, and then what's your biggest joy?
Yeah, so I'd say the biggest challenge is, I mean, as a school, I mean, US is an incredible school with just incredible teachers and these wonderful families and great young men. And yet there's a perception sometimes that people might say, well, I've heard of US, but I know that it's not for someone like me, or it's not for a family like ours. And that's not true, you know? And so I think we just constantly want to be ambassadors for our school to say, if your son is a, you know, a poet, an artist, you know, an athlete, whatever, but if he's bright and he's talented and he has potential to achieve great things, then, you know, this is a place that's been teaching boys since 1890. We want you to take a look. And so it's a great challenge, you know, to be at this unbelievable place that in many ways is still more of an unknown. So I would say that's a challenge. And I would say my greatest joy, there's probably two. Number one is being able to work with, you know, young people who do have this incredible potential and then sort of help guide them to become, you know, the young adults who ultimately will become these, you know, high achieving adults, and being a part of their life at a very transformative time. And in many ways, probably much more so than when they're college age. So I've enjoyed that. I'm really enjoying being able to help my rising seniors who want to play in college sort of navigate this process, because so many of them have this tremendous future in front of them. And yet, you know, I think I can play an important role in helping make an introduction to them that frankly might pay off for them the way all these countless introductions have paid off for me over the years. And then the second thing is selfishly, but like I said, I'm a dad. We have two daughters and we have a son who's in the middle. And I worked for an administrator years ago who at one point in time sent out this, I'd say, thoughtless email to all the coaches and made a statement, no kids on the sideline, or no kids on the field, or something like that. You know, your children shouldn't be there. And I'd been in the department long enough that coaches came to me and like, what is this? And like, I won't even coach if this is how it is. And so I sort of thought about how to navigate, like, we have to address this, but maybe I'm not the one that should be bringing it up, but whatever. So, and thankfully that person realized maybe that wasn't the right statement to make. Well, I've had more fun these last few years having our son who's now 8, you know, and so it's when he was, you know, 7 and 8 these last few years, come to every practice, you know, come to every game, look up to these guys like his superheroes, and then look at the way that they treat him like the, you know, special little guy that he is. That has been the most fun and honestly the most, you know, joy and appreciation I have. And it's probably the thing that I'm most proud to tell every parent as well. Like, this is how your son, in a moment when nobody's looking at him, this is how he treats a 7-year-old, you know, and he thinks of all of them as, like I said, as superheroes. So if that's a challenge and that's a, you know, moment of joy, I would say those would be two things that I reflect on all the time. So,
well, that takes us full circle back to the very top of the podcast with your experience at Hamilton when you were a kid.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, yeah.
You know, you kind of had, you know, a similar type experience, and your son is even more of an insider than you were, because it's not a friend's dad, it's his own dad that's getting an opportunity to do that and have him be around. And I know that from talking to coaches and from talking to kids whose dads were coaches, that there's nothing better than that experience of being able to share that coaching, you know, your coaching duties and your team and everything, your players, to be able to share that with your family, I think makes it extra special. So I want to wrap things up, Sean, by just saying to you,
of course,
thanks for spending some time with us tonight. I really appreciate it. The conversation was a great one for coaches to be able to listen to. I think there was a lot of things that a coach could pull out and learn from your journey and your experiences. And I'm appreciative that you were willing to take time out of your schedule with your family to jump on and share with our audience here on the Hoopheads podcast. So before we get done, I just want to give you a chance to let people know how they can reach out to you, find out more about your basketball program and your school there at University School, and find out a little bit more about what it is that you're building there. And then I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Sure, that's great. So in terms of reaching out, we would certainly welcome any, you know, parent or any, you know, young coach who would like to connect with us about anything. Feel free to reach out to me. My email is S, and then my last name is McDonnell, McDonnell, at us.edu. And, you know, we have a website like all schools as well, and it's easy to remember, www.us.edu. And University School is a, you know, really special place that is an expert in teaching boys and in helping. Our mission statement is to inspire boys of promise to become young men of character who lead and serve. We do that every day, and it's a privilege to sort of be a small, you know, little spoke in the wheel of all the great things that happen at US, and we're always excited to hear from people that want to learn more. So
we'll put all that in the show notes. Sean, again, I can't thank you enough for spending the time with us tonight. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Coaches, we've teamed up with E3 Analytics so you can now purchase three of their exclusive new playbooks. If you're looking for ways to improve your team next season, these playbooks blend affordability with the quality content that serious coaches are looking for. Just visit hoopheadspod.com/store and you'll find playbooks from Coach Don Showalter of USA Basketball, Coach Mike Flynn from the Illawarra Hawks in Australia, who coached LaMelo Ball last season, and Coach Tyler Whitcomb from West Michigan Aviation Academy. Check out these great resources at hoopheadspod.com/store.
The Hoopheads Podcast is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.